gonna rock it and roll it on the moon tonight. We're leaving the earth and we're traveling light. Man, they say it's cold on the other side of the moon. Well, it's gonna get hot. We'll be rocking and rolling as soon. We're gonna rock it and roll it on the moon tonight. My honey got a curve like a satellite. We're gonna get to an orbit on the blue, blue side of the moon. And the way we're going, we're gonna be getting there soon. Ooh, moon rockety, ooh, moon rockety, ooh, moon rockety, ooh, moon rockety. We're gonna be rocking, rocking and rolling there soon. We're leaving the earth and we're traveling light. Man, they say it's cold on the other side of the moon. Well, it's gonna get hot. We'll be rocking and rolling there soon. Ooh, moon rockin', ooh, moon rockin', ooh, moon rockin', ooh, moon rockin'. We're rockin' and rolling, rockin' and rolling there soon. We'll be rockin' and rollin', rockin' and rollin' as soon. We'll be rockin' and rollin', rockin' and rollin' as soon.
And you're listening to CITR Radio, FM 102, Cable 102, Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. And the Nardwuar, the Human Serviette Radio Show. And who do we have on the line right now? Are you there, caller?
Yes, I am. And I can identify the mystery voice.
Who are you?
I don't know. I've had this problem all my life. I've been trying to identify who the hell I am.
Please explain who you are, and also explain maybe who did we just hear?
It sounded like Les Vogt and the Prowlers, because I'm on the phone here, right? Correct,
yeah. Exactly. It was Les Vogt. I thought, make you do the work. And, of course, who are you, please? I'm making you do the work because I'm assuming you know how to do the work, because you have done the work for a very, very long time, haven't you, Brad?
That's right. I am John Tanner's illegitimate son, Red Robinson.
You are Red Robinson here, live on CITR Radio.
Thank you.
FM 102, Cable 102, Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, the Nardwuar to Human Serviette Radio Show. And you're phoning in today kind of to help pimp your brand new book, Backstage Vancouver Red.
That's right. And, you know, we've only got limited time because I only have so many quarters on me because I'm too cheap to buy a cell phone. So, you know, I'm here in the phone booth on 25th and Kingsway.
Well, who exactly are you? For people that don't know who are you, Red Robinson? A bit of background on who you are and what is Backstage Vancouver and where may have people heard of you before?
Where would I begin? Well, born in Comox on Vancouver Island back in 1937, and started a career in radio in Vancouver at the age of 16 at the station CJOR, which is now called CKBD, and was the first guy to play rock and roll on the radio on a regular basis in Canada, and went on from there to a career in radio and television. And the book, you asked about the book, is the history of entertainment in British Columbia, because I'm one of those guys that believes we've got to save the heritage, which keeps ending up in dumpsters when new corporations take over radio stations. They throw the history in the garbage dump, and they're not the only ones. The CBC was doing it for years, and television stations. And so the book came about because I wanted to tell everybody what a rich Canadian and Vancouver story we have with entertainment.
Like, about Les Vogt. Like, we played Les Vogt. Who was Les Vogt? Just quickly, played a bit of Moon Rocketing. Did you release that record? Because Les Vogt, that record is amazing. I love it. And that was early Vancouver rock. That ain't from anywhere else but Vancouver, right? Can you tell that's from Vancouver?
Absolutely. It's Vogt, by the way. Just like you go out and vote, it's a Dutch name. His real name, just let me tell you this, is Van Vogt. Lester Van Vogt. Now, his uncle was A.E. Van Vogt, the very famous science fiction writer. People don't know that. But, no, Les had the first rock and roll band in Canada called the Prowlers. They got their name because they used to appear and make phone calls and do commercials back in the mid-1950s, I'm talking 55 and 56, on the Jack Cullen Show. And Jack Cullen was a great disc jockey, my mentor, and his radio show was called The Owl Prowl. thus the name The Prowlers.
And that song was from 1960, Moon Rocketing. How did you avoid not getting chucked in the garbage, Red Robinson? You mentioned, like, so much of the history of Vancouver has been chucked out. How come you haven't been chucked out? Because so much has been chucked out. How come you didn't end up like the Cave Nightclub?
Well, I can't answer. There's a lot of people probably would figure me as a good candidate to end up in a dumpster, but I prevented myself from doing that. No, but you're asking, I know what you're doing, you're asking a sideways question here, which is interesting. No, the thing is that I'm a collector. I saved everything, all my experiences, audio experiences, video experiences, with artists over the years, as I know, Narwhal, you have too. And but mine just goes back a little further. That's the only difference. And I used to hire a professional photographer and take them along with me. And a lot of those photos are in the book Backstage Vancouver.
I didn't really realize that you actually brought a photographer with you. I just thought they were just already around. But you actually were thinking back then about documenting it.
Exactly. And it wasn't because I was a visionary. God, I'd love to say that. But it was because I was a young kid and I was a fan. I mean, Buddy Holly, Elvis and all were my contemporaries. Just take a look at the, you know, we look like kids because we were kids. Eddie Cochran, all of these people. And I didn't have a vision. All I wanted to do was to preserve the meetings, preserve the conversations. And in doing so, I guess I ended up preserving probably the most and last innocent time in North America.
Red Robinson, you have this brand new book with Greg Potter called Backstage Vancouver. And I learned quite a few interesting things from the book. Number one, the first pizza oven in Vancouver was at the Penthouse Cabaret. Is that true?
That's absolutely true. Isn't that amazing?
I love it. Like pizza at the Penthouse.
Well, you've got to put everything in. If you're going to put something in, you might as well cover pizzas, too. Those are human endeavors. You know what I'm saying?
But I guess you forget about things. Like, I'm talking to you when you were playing stuff. Rock and roll was, like, brand new. And also, you were eating pizza when it was brand new. Like, it's wild to think when stuff was brand new. Like, how weird does it make Vancouver seem that, like, the, you know, Penthouse had the first pizza oven and people were excited about it?
Well, I don't know. How people were excited about it. I think the people that went there, and most of the people that went to the Penthouse in those days, were after-hours performers. They would end up there at 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning, because Vancouver had a very limited number of places that you could go. You could go to a wonderful black woman by the name of Vi's Steakhouse, just off Georgia Street, rather the Georgia Viaduct on Main Street, and she cooked up great steaks and had a wonderful menu. But there's only two or three places you could go after midnight. I mean, this is, you know, this was Vancouver the good in those days, but behind the scene we had our little bad places like, you know, the Penthouse.
Well, I think it's a great place to have pizza there, and that's a little tidbit I picked up from your book, Backstage Vancouver, available now from Harbor Publishing, co-written by Greg Potter as well. Greg Potter!
You know Greg?
Greg Potter from Download and the Lost Durango. It's been kicking it out for years, documenting much great Vancouver rock, and actually right now we're going to bring into the conversation here, not Greg Potter, but Red, I'd like you to be introduced here to Aaron Chapman. Aaron, are you there?
I am here.
Aaron, please explain yourself to Red Robinson.
Well, geez, I don't know if I can do that. I'm honored to talk to you, Red.
Red,
well, hi, Aaron. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Aaron wrote that article you may have read recently in the Vancouver Courier about Howard Hughes. Did you see that, the cover article in the Vancouver Courier on Howard Hughes?
No, damn it, and I wish I'd get it. I don't get the Courier, and they even did a thing on the book, my book in there, and I'm sorry about that, Aaron. I should get a subscription to it, yeah.
I'll email you one.
Aaron, it's,
yeah, please do. Yeah.
I think it's still online, actually, too, isn't
it's still,
it, Aaron?
Yeah.
The Vancouver Courier.
I'd like to ask you, Red. You mentioned Jack Cullen.
That's it. I was going to say, yeah. Aaron, you want to ask about Bing Crosby,
well,
too.
Some of these characters, you mentioned Jack Cullen, and of course, Jack passed away a few years back.
That's right.
And he had that sort of legendary, more than legendary record collection.
Unbelievable.
And I heard a rumor, I was asking somebody else about it, and they said that they were, most of his collection was sort of being sold off in aid of his widow or something. Is that true?
No. Well, I'll give you, if I got a minute, I'll give you the true story, as they say. And it's a sad, sick story. Jack's collection, he sold to CKNW back in 1974, I think,
right.
For, at that time, maybe $150,000, which today would be like $1 million. Anyway, he could be the caretaker of it until he passed away. And so he was. He was the caretaker of it. But when he passed away, the radio station, the manager at the time, took the entire collection and sold it off for $10,000. Now, there were 20 items in there worth $10,000. So it's scattered to the four winds. That's part one. Part two, when Jack died, I had been up to see him at Burnaby Hospital many times, and he was a scallywag. I love the guy. He was, I mean, you know, you talk about people who are on the edge. This guy created it. Anyway, what happened when he passed away, Alma, his wife, asked for help. And so we went there, and Jack had his own collection of things that NW didn't own, and we helped. Yes, you're right, we helped. There was a bunch of us, a cadre of us, who loved the man.
Right.
I got together, and yes, we preserved it. And many of the transcriptions of, like Bill Haley and the Comets doing Armed Forces Radio and stuff like that, we have preserved. Between Bruce Allen, who gets a bad rap from a lot of people, but he's a good guy, and he and myself and a group of us have stored it in a walk-in safe in downtown Vancouver. We've kept the really classic stuff, all the interviews and radio shows.
Were some of his total like radio shows like sort of archived for the time that you could listen to a certain show at from you know like a certain year of his or just scattered to?
Oh no, it's all archived.
Wow.
Who exactly was Jack Cullen for people that don't know Red Robinson?
Sure.
I know him as a bootlegger. Was he one of the most amazing bootleggers ever? What bootlegs of his are the most sought after?
Well, I you could call him a bootlegger. I guess legally that would be a terminology. But let me explain why he did it, and thank God he did. He's preserved a lot of the musical history of this town.
Like Frank Sinatra didn't like Jack Cullen,
well,
right?
No, because this is the scallywag part. You know, he was a rogue in a lot of ways, but he never hurt anybody. He went under the stage in 1957 and planted a tape recorder, and actually the mic that Frank used during his entire concert with Nelson Riddle's orchestra was fed into Jack's tape machine, and then Jack would play it on the air, you see, which was illegal against all of the, you know, American Musicians Union and on and on. And of course it was wrong, but thank God when you look back, he's preserved that moment in time. He did that with Louis Armstrong. He did that with Harry Belafonte. The other things he did was he preserved radio shows like Jack Benny broadcasting live in Vancouver in 1944, Bing Crosby doing his radio show throughout America in 1948. And remember, Bing Crosby, you wouldn't understand this, but 6 out of 10 people who listened to the radio on the night he was on were listening to Bing Crosby.
How many of the bootlegs still survive, of the Cullen bootlegs? Do you have those in the big vault? And are there any rock and roll ones that are still out there?
No, I don't think there's many rock and roll. Jack really was not a fan of rock and roll, which is fine, and it's fair. But yes, all of the things I mentioned have been preserved, and others too. Like, we have Marilyn Monroe's interview from Jack's tapes in our book, you know, verbatim, transcribed. You know, hi Marilyn, hi Jack, da-da-da-da, because Marilyn, he interviewed her at the Vancouver International Airport in 1953.
Where else have Jack Cullen's recordings surfaced? Have they ended up anywhere else, on other CDs or in other books or anything like that? Like, I know didn't he do the Beatles? He did the one that did the Beatles and
yes.
The Elvis?
Yeah, there you go. He did do the Beatles, and he put out a double vinyl thing, and it was a bootleg, just as you said, and it was sold all over the world, but there was no label, no mailing address, nothing like it. But again, just an incredible document when you listen to it. And
are you on there? Are you on that actual tape? Because you introduced
yes.
The Beatles.
Oh yes, you can hear everything except John Lennon telling me to F off the stage. Everything else is on there.
And Red Robinson, we're speaking here to Red Robinson. If anybody has any questions to Red Robinson, it's 604-822-2487. That's 604-UBC-CITR. And we have Red Robinson here live in an Ardwater Human Survey Radio Show talking about his brand new book with Greg Potter, Backstage Vancouver.
Can I butt in just a second, Narwhal?
Yes.
I was going to ask Aaron about this story on Howard Hughes. I find the man incredibly fascinating. Was your story about his 6 month stay here in Vancouver?
That's exactly what it was, yeah. Yeah, in 1972 when he was at the Weston Bayshore.
Yeah, you know what, Aaron? I used to go, I was doing morning show at the time for 12 and a half years on CKWX, and I'd go by every morning, and those two top floors were lit up where the rest of the hotel was pretty, you know, black looking.
Yeah.
An amazing, amazing story. An amazing man. I mean, he didn't live much long
after that.
Longer after.
One of the sources that I had for the story was Chuck Davis, who I know,
yes.
who you know, who's a great storyteller and great historian.
Oh, no kidding.
Vancouver stuff. And when he was working at the time for BCTV, when he tried to gain access to the top floor to interview somebody, of course, he was ushered away by bodyguards and whatnot.
Mormon bodyguard,
yeah.
Had you had any run-ins with Howard Hughes previous to that, Red Robinson? Because I think in your book, didn't it mention about Yvonne DiCarlo partying with Howard Hughes in the 60s? Not when he was in Vancouver in the 70s,
but
in the actual 60s.
Yes, I'll tell you what that was. Avonda Carlo is a Vancouver girl. She went to King Edward High School. Her real name's Peggy Middleton. She actually graduated with Jack Cullen, which, if you tie all these things together, it's funny, isn't it? But, no, she came back to her hometown quite often, and one time she came back, flew in with her date, which was Howard Hughes. And the part in the book where that is referred to was Dal Richards meeting them at the roof of the Hotel Vancouver.
Another interesting little fact learned from Backstage Vancouver. Another thing you set straight in that book there, Red Robinson, was I always thought that Errol Flynn, who died in Vancouver, I thought his cock was cut off and was left in Vancouver. But in your book, I found out it wasn't his cock cut off. It was just the warts cut off him. What can you say about the Errol Flynn cock incident?
Well, you know, you have to do research to find it out. You know, if it's not a first-hand news report, which... thank God this wasn't. It came from Glenn McDonald, the former coroner of Vancouver, in his book. And they removed...
How Come I'm Dead was the name of the book.
Exactly,
right?
And yeah. A wonderful book. But what a macabre sense of humor the guy had, Eddie.
Yeah.
And it was 1310 Burnaby Street.
1310 Burnaby Street,
in the
yeah.
West End. You can actually go there. It's still there. Yeah. It's still there, where actually Errol Flynn died. I don't know the apartment number.
Yeah, but you know whose apartment it was?
Glenn Gould.
Grant Gould.
Grant Gould, his best friend's brother, wasn't it?
No, his cousin.
Cousin, that's who, that was it.
That's right. Dr. Grant Gould happened to be my mother's physician.
Wow.
And you're right, his cousin was Glenn Gould, the pianist, and a great classical pianist. But matter of fact, Grant lives today in Anaheim, California. You know, this sounds like we're doing trivia, doesn't it? I'm sorry.
Speaking of trivia.
We love the trivia. It's just amazing. But Errol Flynn, back to the warts there, Red Robinson. His cock was not cut off. What was the deal? His warts were cut off and then taped back on and then shipped to California. Like, famous people have passed through Vancouver. Like, Harding almost died in Vancouver. What famous people have died in Vancouver? Like, Errol Flynn died in Vancouver. And could you finish the story? What happened with the warts?
Okay, well, not Glenn didn't do it. His assistant did. He cut off the genital warts. And Glenn came back and said, for God's sake, you're not supposed to do that. So they reattached him with Scotch tape. And the thing in the book is true. They sent the body down, of course, to Los Angeles, to another forensic lab. And it always amazed Glenn McConnell that nobody ever questioned the Scotch tape. So there you go. That is the true story.
And you're speaking here to Nardwuar the Human Serviette, and you're speaking to, hopefully, callers, 604-822-2487, UBCCATR. If you have any questions to ask Red Robinson, author of the brand-new book, Backstage Vancouver, with Greg Potter. Another thing that I learned about from the book, Backstage Vancouver, Boris Karloff working at the P&E. That was fascinating. The Boris Karloff-Vancouver connection.
Yeah, when they first built the P&E back in the 1920s, he was a carpenter. His name was William H. Pratt, P-R-A-T-T. You know, like Pratt & Whitney Engines, it's an old English name. But he really wanted to be an actor, and so would spend time at the Lyric Theater in bit parts, and actually traveled around British Columbia quite extensively over the years, you know, acting. Then he decided to lift his mother's name, Karloff, his mother's maiden name, and put the Boris in front of it, said it sounded more sophisticated for its time. And, of course, went on to become a legend. But he when you go to the P&E, part of those buildings were built by the one and only Boris Karloff.
Caller, are you there?
Yes, hi there.
Go ahead to Red Robinson, William Jans.
I wanted to say that I'm a long-time caller, first-time listener. And I wanted to ask, you mentioned that John Lennon said to get the F off the stage, as you said. What was that for? Was it just he wanted to be up there longer, or were you there too long, or what?
No. I mean, if I, you know, trespassed, of course I knew I didn't want to go up on the
now,
stage.
No, just a second, Red. You weren't kicked in the balls as well, were you?
No, only my voice was. But anyway, listen.
Baboom.
The guy, the inspector of the Vancouver Police Department, and Brian Epstein, their manager, told me to get up there because it was out of hand. You'll see this, by the way, in a video called The Complete Beatles. And so I get up there, and I wait for the end of a song, and I go out there, and Paul is just starting to say something on the mic. And I say, excuse me, and here were my orders. You got to back up and quiet down, or the Beatles aren't going to perform. As I'm walking out on the stage before I utter those words, John Lennon says, what are you doing up here? Get the F off our stage. Nobody interrupts the Beatles. So now I have photographs of me going over, talking to John, screaming at him, and he's screaming at me because the noise of the crowd is so loud. And I'm saying, listen, I don't want to be up here either, but I said, look down on the corner of the stage. Brian is waving. I said, your manager sent me up here, and the chief of police, not the chief of police, but the police guy there, and they want me to tell everybody, okay, carry on, mate. But nobody ever hears that other part of the story where he said, carry on, mate, And my son used to say to me, Dad, it doesn't matter what the hell you do in your career, you're going to be remembered as the guy that John Lennon told to F off the stage.
And you were only filling in, weren't you, Red Robinson? Like Fred Latremont couldn't make it. You were only filling in. You were the fill-in guy.
The fill-in guy in a way, but please understand something. I was the program director and on the air there. And I designated Freddie to be the MC, but he got mononucleosis and was at the hospital UBC, right where you guys are.
How much is audible of the F off, fuck off, on the actual tape? Can you actually hear it? Is it documented anywhere? Did it actually happen? Are you making it up, Red Robinson? Because this would have been the best publicity ever for you to make this story up. I mean, how can anybody dispute it?
Well, it wasn't a big item at the time.
Is it documented on any tapes? Like, can you hear it in the background?
You can hear it in the background on one of the ones that I have here at the house, yeah.
Caller, any other questions for Red Robinson?
No, but I hope he's got more quarters if he's standing at the corner of Kingsway and Main plugging.
Well, thank you very much. You just reminded me. I just heard a kind of a beep sound there. I guess I'd
probably... Oh, come on. Quarter. Don't chicken out. Keep talking. You got lots of people listening.
Okay,
thanks
well,
for the question. I better run, friend.
Well, thanks much, William, and doot doot loot doo.
Me too.
Doot doot loot doo.
Me too? I like that
okay,
one.
Okay, that'll work. Okay,
okay do, there you go.
Okay, and we have another caller. Caller, are you there?
I'm here.
Go ahead to Red Robinson. Do you know who Red Robinson is?
I sure do.
He's author of a brand new book called Backstage Vancouver, where you learn all sorts of neat little bits of trivia, which you don't really like the word trivia, do you, Red?
Oh, I like the word trivia. What the hell? I did a national TV show that prompted three of my contestants to end up with Trivial Pursuit.
Actually, yeah, that is true. You do like, wait, maybe you don't like the word trivia because Trivial Pursuit got a lot of money for a lot of other people and not you, right?
Oh, well, we made some money. The guy that created it was a man called Jan Nablo, who created it at the, I forget the name of the pub out there, at the Cecil Green at UBC.
Oh, and, out there, yeah.
And took it down to Ken Gibson. We used to do variety shows, Aaron, as you know, at CBC. And it became a national show, and three of the guys were unemployed journalists in Toronto. I mean, we know a lot of unemployed journalists. They're good friends of ours. But anyway, they sat down and came up with the game. And the thing is, this is interesting, Narwhal, because they had to call it a pursuit, a Trivial Pursuit, because Jan and I registered the name when the CBC would not put a game out. We wanted a game out. And I got game companies wouldn't put it out. So we had our, prototype. But those guys got their own money together. I give them full marks and went ahead and put it out. But they couldn't use the name Trivia. They had to use Trivial Pursuit because I registered the damn thing in Ottawa, in Washington, D.C., and in London, England. So they couldn't use the word Trivia.
Which I think is great because it was that band Bush. Remember the band Bush featuring Dominic Triano, who later joined the Guess Who out of Toronto?
That's correct.
And because they were called Bush way before the Bush from England in Canada had to be called Bush X. So I love the way that Canadians fit in there. Caller, do you have a question for Red Robinson?
I thought you forgot about me.
No, he did forget about you, but I didn't.
It's an honor to be speaking with you, Mr. Robinson. Anyways, my mom went to the Elvis.
Hold on a second here. Hold on a second here. Red, what do you? Sorry, caller. What do you think about questions that begin with "my mom"? Does it make you feel old? Does it make you feel old? Or are you ready so old that it doesn't matter?
It doesn't matter. It's a compliment. My God, you can't lie about who you are, what you are, if you're an honest person. Anyway, go ahead with your question, my love.
Well, I find it a source of pride that my mother saw Elvis Presley in concert, but she was so disappointed because he wasn't able to sing for very long because everybody freaked out, apparently.
No kidding. They did it 7 years later at the Beatles show, the same damn thing.
What the hell is wrong with people? And she was
beside herself. What's your first name?
My name?
Your name.
Angela.
Angela. Hear me, Angela. You got to understand something, and then to put it in the right context. There's too many things in life today where you just make statements or it's just too easy. But, you see, before Elvis Presley, not a Frank Sinatra, not Bing Crosby, not anybody, was big enough to rent stadiums. He was the first guy ever to do it. So here's my point.
Yeah.
And in the only thing is that Brian Epstein's people should have known it, too. That Elvis was at Empire, but they sold seats in the stands. Just imagine the dome and no seats sold, or GM Place, no seats sold on the floor. So, of course, everybody went down onto the field, and there was no security.
Oh, my God.
So Elvis lasted 22 minutes. The Beatles did 27.
He only made it through a couple songs. Now, my question to you would be, do you remember which songs they were? Because she does not recall. She was obviously too excited. Do you have any recollection of what he sang, what he got through?
the list of songs he got through.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, email me or have your mom at red@redrobinson.com, and I'll give her the whole list of the songs that were played.
That were played. Okay, I'll do that. What is it again?
Just red@redrobinson.com.
red@redrobinson.com. Okay, I'll do that. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks so much, caller. Anything else you want
to
add?
To your mom.
Anything else you anything else you want to add to Red Robinson at all, caller?
Well, I'm going to get that book for my brother's birthday because he's a huge rock and roll fan, rock and roll history fan. So.
Oh, well, thank you for that.
Well, thanks so much, caller, and doot-doot-a-loot-doo. And you're still listening to CITR Radio, FM 102, Cable 102, Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, and the Nardwuar Human Serviette Radio Show. And we have Red Robinson live on the phone here now talking about his brand new book with Greg Potter, And you can phone and ask Red some questions, 604-822-2487, about his book Backstage Vancouver. And also in the studio we have A.O. Chapman from the Town Pants on Bukvifa Skring. And A.O., you have a question about Venues Vancouver and Bing Crosby. Crosby incident.
Well, it's sort of a two-part thing. First of all, I love the book. I got it for Christmas myself.
Thank you, Aaron.
And it's amazing. And the last caller was talking about anybody that's a fan of rock and roll history. I think if you're I'm born and raised in Vancouver myself, and I think if you think Vancouver is a dull place, grab this book and read it because you'll be fascinated about everything. But one question I have is a story that I had heard rumor of.
Sure.
That didn't get into the book, which is when Bing Crosby showed up in Vancouver and he was refused at a hotel because they didn't know it was him. He was dressed down.
You know, the thing was, we wanted to do that too, Aaron, and I guess it'll be the second book called Son of Backstage Vancouver or Daughter. But no, that's absolutely true. And what's funny about that? I mean, we knew about it. We couldn't get all the stories in.
Yeah.
But he showed up from a fishing trip. And he looked like a bum. You know how guys do when they go up fishing. I mean, I don't know if you do or not, but I used to years ago. And you got a crummy-looking hat on, and he's, you know, disheveled clothes. And he gets up to the counter, and the guy behind the counter says, "I'm sorry, we don't accept bums." And he goes, you know, front, and one of the security guys takes and throws him out in the street.
Wow.
Now, that made headlines in Los Angeles, too. And what was so funny, in the next road movie they made, Hope and Crosby, they included a scene like this because the guy behind the counter looked like a stand-in for Bob Hope. He looked like Hope.
Another thing in the book that I can't help but read, and especially somebody myself who worked as a musician in Vancouver, when you see the old photos of the cave, and even going back to like the old like vaudeville era places, and the Vancouver the Opera House,
right?
You can't help but think, geez, I wish these places were still around, and it makes me think, you know, in my early 20s, going to the Town Pump and playing there, and the stories that I know,
oh, sure,
of there, I wish, in a way, I wish that made it into the book too. And I realize for space, you can only put so much in, and maybe for Son of Backstage Vancouver, it'll be there. But I can't help but think, like, it's just a shame that we've lost these things, and it would be so great to go to the cave now and see it.
Oh yeah.
What is still there right now? What is still here right now that people should check out before it gets, you know, taken away?
Well, the Commodore, I think, is the greatest tribute to the current crop of people who run the music business, the Bruce Allens, the Sam Feldmans, and the House of Blues guys, too, because they saved that, and they poured millions into it. That's one of them. The Orpheum is another. I mean, I was...
How about the Sunset Community Center? Is that still there?
Cause it's still there. It's still there. And Bing actually, as you know, Aaron... Well, you might know anyway, but Bing really saved that and made it happen by raising $25,000, which today would be $1 million. You know?
Yeah.
Caller, are you there?
Yes.
Go ahead to Red Robinson.
Hi, Red.
Hi.
Hi, my name's Francis, and I'm in my early 50s, and my friends and I like to talk about the old days, when we were children, and we got this real fascination, and it's great that you're talking about old Vancouver at this time, and the old days of the Strand Theater and the Orpheum,
God, yes.
And remember Scott's Cafe?
Oh, terrific. Everybody went out. I mean, everybody hung out.
Caller, could you explain a bit about these places for people that may not know? What was Scott's Cafe?
Okay. Well, Scott's Cafe and the Strand had this old-world elegance to them.
Yes.
That you don't see. Everything's cheap and tawdry now and plastic. And trampled. Everything's covered in grease. It's filthy. It's disgusting.
Hold on a second.
Where was it?
Hold on a second. This is not the Christian evangelical.
Well, it doesn't matter. What he's saying is true. Listen to me.
But we love nowadays. I love the past, but now is good,
too.
I love internet.
Pure squalor.
let me tell you. Back in the old... But I want to get to a point about this, isn't that...
Where was Scott's? Where was Scott's in the city?
Scott's was right next to... Is, almost at George and Granville. It's right across from Eaton's, where Eaton's was downtown, the big white Eaton's, like Granville in Georgia.
Right.
That's correct.
Okay.
And it was part of the whole thing. Like Granville Street was where it was at back in those days.
Yeah.
And I was a little bit too young.
The Grand was opposite the bay on Georgia, so
it's right around the corner.
The bank now, yeah.
It was just around the corner.
Yep.
And like the bank that's there now, that's really ugly. That's bad architecture. But the Strand
terrible.
Was gorgeous, right? And I really cried when they tore the Strand down. Just like when they shut down the Stanley. I mean, you know, the Stanley, I love the Stanley Theater, right? But anyway, I want to get to another point. And that is we talk a lot about the old days. We look at old photographs of our fathers and stuff walking down Granville, get their pictures taken.
Right.
And we've theorized about, you know, what our fathers told us and other old guys in their 80s have told us about Vancouver in those days. And touching on what you were saying about Jack Cullen and that whole jazz scene, because when all those people like Mitzi Gaynor, Vancouver was part of a circuit, and people would try out their acts before they'd take them to Vegas.
That's absolutely correct, and we do mention that in the book, yep.
And then all these show business people would come up here, they'd stay at the Bayshore Inn. And I remember the Bayshore Inn being really like an American Vegas kind of place back in 64, and they had the...
Trader Vic's.
Trader Vic's, oh God, like, I love Trader Vic's, right? The whole tiki...
Now, why was Vancouver kind of like the thing that people prepared for before Vegas? Was there any other cities? Why particularly Vancouver?
No, they prepared, as our friend on the phone is saying, they prepared their acts for Vegas and Reno in those days. Reno was quite the city in those days. They came up here because we had the facilities, we had the venues, we had the Cave, we had Izzy's later on, and earlier we had the Palomar, we had the Commodore.
And why did we have so many venues?
Oh, because people loved entertainment in Vancouver, always had.
Vancouver's a funky place, too. Like, people would come up here fishing and sailing and doing stuff,
that's
right?
True.
And
yeah.
But anyway, I wanted to get to a point, and the point was that these entertainers would come up here, stay at the Bayshore, they'd perform at the Cave, and then when they'd be done performing, like guys like Sammy Davis Jr. that, they'd all go to Joe Filippone's house on Seymour Street next to the penthouse.
To his house, that's correct.
He had a house there, so the house is still there. It's all beat up and closed up now.
Next door.
He had the best parties in Vancouver were there.
Oh, and
my friend's father was a realtor back then, and he used to go down there and party with them.
Oh, some nights, your dad would tell you this, you could go in there, and if he was partying with them, and there would be Sammy Davis Jr., there would be Frankie Lane, there would be Stan Kenton, there would be Gary Cooper.
What do you remember about any parties you went there? Red Robinson.
That's some of the names I'm telling you, like Sammy Davis Jr. and Frankie Lane. And
were you actually at a party with Sammy Davis Jr., and how approachable would he be at this party?
Oh, he would. Hey, Sammy goes back to when he was with the Will Maston Trio when he was a little kid, and they used to come here to the Palomar. And you see, the difference was, instead of coming for one-night stands like we get today, these guys would be here for a week or two. A
week engagement, yeah.
And they'd get to know everybody.
Yeah.
They get to know the local media, like Bob Smith, the jazz guy, and Jack Cullen, and we'd all pal around.
And anyway, the point I was trying to get to was Joe Filippone's house was like the culture, well, not cultural, but it was the social center of Vancouver back then.
That's right.
And Joe Filippone, well, let's face it, I mean, there were a lot of prostitutes hanging around like his place, right?
Well, I'll tell you what.
It was a bordello, basically.
Then they threw him out in the street. That was brilliant.
What's wrong with that? What's wrong with that, caller?
I'm trying to make a point.
But I'm saying, hold on, caller.
Okay, I got a point to make. Let me make it.
But can I make a point?
Here's the point.
Can I make a point?
I want to finish what I'm saying.
Well, how do you know I'm not going to let you finish what you're saying?
Okay, come on, back down.
Wait a second. How do you know I'm not going to let you finish what you want to say, caller? How do you know that, caller?
He's going to let you finish.
How do you know that, caller?
You're going to let me finish. Fine.
How do you know?
Okay, go ahead.
No, okay, well, I was going to go at you. You can, well, now that...
Okay, okay, fine.
Okay.
What I wanted to say was this. Okay, here were the Filippone's in their house. They were the center of Vancouver's social life, and it was a real boozy crowd. And what I've talked to a lot of guys about this who knew this back then. The chief of police would go down there.
Yeah.
Old man Bentall was there. A young Jimmy Patterson was there. Okay? The Mayor Hume was down there. And that place was the effective city hall of Vancouver. Joe Filippone's sort of bordello whorehouse on Seymour was the real place where Vancouver was built.
You're not far out. I mean, that's one way of looking at it, for sure. Now, Narwhal, what were you going to say? You're going to change yourself from a serviette to a napkin? What was that?
Well, no, I was just going to say, caller, I'm not going to cut you off, caller.
Okay.
Okay.
That's all I wanted to say. To me, I just wanted to get this point about, you know,
It's very true. I think it's very true. I think Vancouver obviously was a smaller town then as well.
Oh, very much.
Yeah.
And everybody rubbed shoulders, and there were less places. You might say there's probably less places to go now. Maybe there were even lesser places then, as Red was saying.
No, I think
earlier.
It was a better social life then. And I wanted to mention one other name that maybe you haven't mentioned yet, and that is Jack Wasserman.
Oh, yeah.
He was down there all the time.
Well, Jack was the pulse of our city, and I'll tell you something. Being in the media all my life, and all of us in the media, and this is the truth. Somebody said, well, how powerful was he? I said, I'll tell you how powerful he was. I would be getting a shoe shine down at the basement of the Vancouver Hotel, and the newspapers would come. You know, the newspaper kid would come by and throw them down. The guys who were businessmen would pick up the paper. Would they look at the headline? No. They go to the second front page bottom to look at Jack Wasserman's column to see if their name's in it.
Thank you very much for phoning in, caller. Any other questions for Red Robinson at all, caller?
No, thanks a lot, Red.
Well, thanks so much,
buddy.
Caller.
Have
and doot doot a loot doo.
Doot doot.
And you're still listening to CITR Radio, FM 102, Cable 102, Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, and an Ardwar to Human Serviette Radio Show. And if you have any questions for Red Robinson, it's 604-822-2487, UBC CITR. Red Robinson is talking to me about his brand new book, Backstage Vancouver, co-authored with Greg Potter. We also have A.O. Chapman here live on an Ardwar to Human Serviette Radio Show. A.O. Chapman plays in the Town Pants and Bufifa's King. Now, another thing that I learned from your book, Red Robinson, was about Bruce Fairbairn, the producer, Bruce Fairbairn, working trumpet into every recording he ever recorded. Now, could you do a bit of information background on this, i.e., he recorded like Motley Crue and Metallica, and he always worked in the trumpet? Always?
He loved it. And that was just sort of like his little signature. You know, like you get an artist doing a painting, he puts his, sometimes hides little things in there that are only he knows about. Just an incredible ear. A set of ears, really, that Bruce had, and passed away too young.
And just the way he could, like, squeeze it in there, whether it be Metallica, Motley Crue, Bon Jovi, he, like, squeezed it in there.
Yeah, that's right.
All right, Vancouver. There was also something described in your book, an amazing drum battle. Gene Krupa, this other phone caller really got me charged up here. Gene Krupa versus Buddy Rich.
Yeah.
This is amazing. You emceed that?
Yeah, can you imagine? Now, here I was, already established as a major rock and roll DJ in the country, but I love jazz, too. I have an incredible collection of jazz. Ask Bobby Hales or these guys. You know, they're always surprised, I think, that I had so much of it. But anyway, what happened was there was a place called the Cellar. Well, we have a jazz cellar now, but the original was up on Main Street in Vancouver. And Ken Hole, who ran it, said, Bob Smith is not feeling well. Red, would you come down and MC Jazz at the Philharmonic? I said, what? I said, I'd be thrilled to you. Are you sure? And he said, yeah. So here I am. I think I was 17 at the time. And I get on the stage, and I'm introducing people like Lester Young. And Ella Fitzgerald, and these are memories that stay with me. But the big highlight was, ladies and gentlemen, the Chicago drum style, Gene Krupa, and the incredible Buddy Rich, and the Battle of the Drums. And honest to God, it went on and brought the place to its knees, of course.
Was that recorded by Jack Cullen at all?
No, but you know, but let me give you an answer. No, it was not. But interestingly, somebody recorded that tour, because I have it on CD.
Wow.
Yep.
You know, did you know that this is a little bit of trivia for you? I'm not sure if you're aware of it. Duke Ellington's grandson now lives in Vancouver, Paul Ellington.
I did not know that.
He married a Vancouver girl.
Oh, for crying out loud.
Oh, I know. So that's just throwing that in with the jazz stuff.
Well, I mean, this is why we need part two, because, I mean, you got lots of things like Phil Collins' former wife and all that, and the daughters are here.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah.
Red Robinson, and you are Red Robinson, 604-822-2487, UBC-CITR. If anybody has any questions for Red Robinson about his book, Backstage Vancouver. You're a very nice guy, Red Robinson. Well, John Lennon told you to fuck off, but generally, I mean, you've survived. You've survived in the industry this long. There's not many DJs that have been on the air as long as you have, or have been in the industry, or have succeeded to the amount that you have. I mean, you've done very, very well. Now, how have you done this? I understand that you have had some run-ins with people. For instance, the time you fought Allen Ginsberg. What was it like fighting Allen Ginsberg and winning Red Robinson?
Well, I don't know if you win. I don't think you have debates to win. Maybe you do. No, what happened was I was programming CJOR at that time and had put it into a talk format. One of the talk guys with Jack Wasserman went on with his own talk show. And I'm sitting out in the hallway and Alan's there. And it was the height of the protest movement, the, you know, everything's wrong with our country and all this crap. And I just listened to it and I gave counterpoints to it. That's all. And I just said, I with all of its faults, I'd rather live here than, you know, Russia or somewhere else. Or, you know, pick a place. I don't care. Uruguay. I like it here.
Did you find people went after you because you were an older DJ at that time? Like, it wasn't the hip 60s sort of DJ? You were like a 50s DJ?
No, not then. Well, probably now, but not then.
Because I would see that as an insult that they wanted Fred Latrimon to introduce the Beatles and not you.
No. Back to the story now. I was the program director. I picked Fred out of all the guys on the air. I had Terry David Mulligan, Daryl Burlingham, Daryl B, as he was known. All these was the C-Fun good guys, and it was my job. And I said, Fred, I think you're the guy to go and do it. And he was selected to do it, and he got sick. That's the truth.
And he got to record a record called Latrimotion, and you were supposedly going to record a record called the G.I. Rock or whatever. Whatever happened to that? What happened to your record, Red?
Oh, God, I got to get you a copy of that, because I did, but it was never put on disc. I've only got the tapes. I've got the tapes, yeah.
Hey, yo, you have a question.
I did, yeah. Amongst the book covers, like the big highlights of Elvis coming and sort of and the Kerrisdale Arena Bill Haley show, which must have been one of the first rock and roll concerts in Canada.
It was
little old Kerrisdale where I grew up. But I'm curious to know, like, after the Elvis came through, there must have been places for kids to go and see shows. Was there a club that the kids could go to, or there was a place there were regular local
and
early rock and roll bands?
Supplement to AO's question. Also, where was the very first rock and roll gig in Vancouver? Was it the Bill Haley gig, and was that the first rock and roll gig in Canada, or had there been local gigs before that in Vancouver or Toronto?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. You know, you fire so many questions out. A bullet's going to hit me somewhere. So let's start with Haley.
Sure.
June of 1956, it was the first rock and roll concert in this town. I doubt if he played Toronto that year, but I could be wrong, so I don't want to say that. But definitely it was the first rock and roll concert ever rolled out in North America, and then it went to England.
Wow.
So that was that. Where did the kids hang out? There were no clubs for them at the time.
There were no places to see local rock bands?
Yes, but you'd have to go at night. We had the old Fender Auditorium
right
upstairs, mainly emphasizing rhythm and blues, which I love. Right. That's my favorite.
Which just burned down recently.
Which just burned down, that's right.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's mentioned in the book as well, because that's where Iggy played with the Stooges.
Yes.
Iggy and the Stooges. Now, is that photo in the book of Iggy at the Pender Ballroom? Because some of the photos in the book are a bit mixed up, they're red. Like, there's a picture of the Rolling Stones that said it's from 1966, but it's really the Rolling Stones from the 70s because Ron Wood is in the picture.
I know. You know what happens once in a while with your editorial people? They cut it up the wrong way, and you're absolutely right. There are some mistakes. There is in every book. But I can't apologize for that because it just happens, you know.
I mean,
Aaron could tell you that. It could happen with the stories in the Courier.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
But it wasn't done on purpose, I'll tell you that. And no. Yes, we recognize it. Yep.
Caller, are you there? Caller, are you there? Okay. Caller, are you there?
Nadlarski.
Go ahead, Hans Kloss, to Red Robinson.
That's right. Listen, do you know anything more about Neil Diamond? I heard he was the biggest pain in the ass that ever was in Vancouver.
Well, he's got that reputation, and yes. There was Mario Caravetta, who used to run the Coliseum, you know, before GM Place was built. And he used to put all the shows in there. Actually told me this story years later where they'd walked Neil Diamond through and he had to have all of the waiters who were serving the food blindfolded. Do not look upon him.
Oh, my God.
So my respect for him went down the tube. I happen to like some of his music. I think he's a good songwriter, but... Where does all this crap come from? I never got that out of an Elvis Presley. I never got that out of a Fats Domino or anybody. I mean, I want so many colored jelly beans. Where'd all this crap start?
How easy was it to be a groupie back then? In the book, you talk about Minka, the groupie. How easy was it to be a groupie back then?
Oh, well, Were you talking the 60s, the Stones and Beatles era, or the 50s, the Presley and Haley era? Which one?
I guess the Presley and Haley era. And also, caller, do you have any other questions, Hans?
No, I'm just not going to take your time anymore.
But thanks,
Hans.
Oh, thanks much. And doot doot a loot doo.
Two.
And you're still listening to CITR Radio, FM 102, Cable 102, Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, the Nardwater Human Survey Radio Show. We're speaking here to Red Robinson, who has a brand new book out called Backstage Vancouver with Greg Potter. If you have any questions for Red, it's 604-822-247. Sorry, Grant, we cut you off. Please phone back. 604-822-247. UBC CITR. We also have A.O. Chapman from The Thief is King and the Town Pants live here on CITR Radio. This is what I was wondering. You're talking about how, like, when people came to town, you know, all this media got to hang out with them way back when. How hard was it to be a groupie way back when? Was it pretty easy to be a groupie way back when?
No, you're talking about, when you say a groupie, you're referring to me, and I don't take that as an insult, or you're...
No, I'm talking about Minka!
I wanted to follow them.
Minka, maybe you could tell a bit about Minka the groupie. Minka!
Minka the groupie from the 60s?
No, Minka, who's in your book. Minka the groupie.
That was a Dal Richards story, though, in the book, I think.
Yeah, it was just some groupie.
The Dal story, yeah.
Okay, sorry
about
that.
But let me just tell you this, how the times have changed. I was telling someone, it was Bruce Allen and Sam Feldman the other day, and I said, you know, how was it in the 50s? Why did you love it so much? Why did we love it? And I said, I'll tell you why. We had a thing called the Irvin Feld Show of Stars, and on that program were the Everly Brothers, Sam Cooke, Paul Anka. Paul and I talked about that when he was in town recently. And there was about 12 acts. They'd all come out and do their hit and maybe one other. And if the things were really crazy, they'd ask for an encore for one song. But you get in for $2.50, and that was the old Georgia Auditorium. But after the show, the Everly Brothers, Buddy Knox, and the Rhythm Orchids, about eight of us went over to the White Spot and had a hamburger. Now, you don't do that today.
Red Robinson, 604-822-2487, UBC CITR. If you have any questions for Red Robinson, author of the brand new book, Backstage Vancouver, with Greg Potter. What records were hits in Vancouver and hits nowhere else?
Oh, where do you want to start?
Or in the Northwest.
There were tons, because you know what they call them, territorial hits. Doesn't matter which city you go into in North America. In those days, the DJs had a lot of power. More so than the stars on the records, actually. And, you know, so we play things. But what was interesting is DJs could pick their own music. What a breakthrough that was. And we'd say to the listeners, do you like it or don't you like it? And they'd, you know, make up their minds whether they liked it or not and buy them or not buy them. And nowadays, of course, it's all, you know, cut and dried, cookie cutter style. And if it's not on a chart somewhere in Chicago or in New York, you're not going to get it played. And I liked our time when we could expose so much new, wonderful talent. It was the Renaissance period, where you could have a little label called Imperial Records with a man owned by a man called Lou Chud.
But any particular...
giving you Fats Domino.
Any particular hits that you remember, any particular ones? Like, you pioneered Buddy Holly. Did Buddy Holly break first in Vancouver, all over North America?
Yes, that's true. With That'll Be the Day. And in those days, the quick answer to that, there were 12 disc jockeys listed in Cashbox magazine every week with their top 10. I was one of them. And I put That'll Be the Day in there for 4 weeks running. And finally, some of the other guys, like Robin Seymour and those, picked it up and played it and said, this is a hit.
Were there any other artists that thanked you for that? Because I know Buddy thanked you for that. Were there any others that thanked you for that? And what were the other artists that broke in Vancouver or were local Northwest hits?
Richie Valens.
Richie Valens was.
Come On, Let's Go. First time it charted here.
When did artists not start caring about stuff?
When did artists stop caring?
Yeah.
I don't know. Real artists never do.
And callers never stop caring. Caller, are you there?
Yes.
Go ahead to Red Robinson.
Hello, Red.
How are you, sir?
Good. Yeah, thanks very much. Yeah, That'll Be the Day. That was good. I have made the pilgrimage to Cleveland, Ohio several times.
Oh, good.
To the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Did you get up to the Dedicated to the One I Love display?
I'm not sure if I found that one. I kind of got hung up on the Ramones Converse sneakers.
Oh, that's great, isn't it?
And the actual lyrics to Blitzkrieg Bop. But anyways, one of the reasons that I went to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is because, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure that you are the only Vancouverite, possibly one of the only Canadians in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I don't think they've elected Tommy Chong yet. But I'm very proud of this Vancouver fact that you're in there. But both times I went there, I could not find your plaque.
Well, there's not plaques. Here's how it works.
And let's just say there's another Vancouverite in there, David Marston. That not true?
Well, yeah, he's not Vancouver, though. He's Toronto, but you're right.
He does live here. There's,
first of all, let's say, this is like three of us. The late Jungle Jane Nelson from Chum in Toronto, David Marston, and myself were the only three Canadians. And where it is, caller, this is why I say, did you go and look at the dedicated, the one I love display? It's on the second floor.
Is that the dark room?
No, that's different. This is the room where you walk in and there's Alan Freed, and there's a setup of the original Sun Record Studios, donated by Sam Phillips, and the room is just surrounded with radios and TV monitors. You go up to a TV monitor, and a map of North America comes up. You touch Vancouver, you got a headset on now. I come up, and it so happens that when you hear me, it's me and Bill Haley. That's how they've done it for all the 80 of us who are in there.
Oh, okay.
There's no plaque. There's no plaques.
See, I thought maybe like even possibly a to scale wax model or something.
Oh, God, a wax model. No. There's 80 DJs, and we're all in that interactive way, which I love. If we ever do a comparable thing in Vancouver where we salute entertainment, that's the way to do it. It comes to life for you, you know?
But you were the first Canadian in there, and definitely the first Vancouverite, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right, yeah.
Yeah, well, congratulations on that history.
Caller!
That rock and roll history.
Caller, any other questions at all for Red Robinson?
No, but Leora Kornfeld could probably get that museum going because she's making all that interactive stuff these days.
Who's that?
A former CBCer is working on some interactive stuff.
Oh, interesting.
And the last thing I'd say is I've found Aaron Chapman's anecdotes over the past 90 minutes to be fascinating.
Caller,
did you check out Aaron Chapman's article on Howard Hughes in the Vancouver Courier?
I did see that. My previous comment was sarcastic, but I did see the Howard Hughes article, and that was, admittedly pretty good.
All right, thanks so much, caller, and doo-doo-da-loo-doo.
One other thing, did you know that Aaron Chapman is a bit of a Howard Hughes himself, living in a penthouse on a beautiful building on Richard Street?
That's right.
How he pulls that off.
That's right.
Well, thanks.
Who do?
thank you, caller. And if anybody has any other questions for Red Robinson or Aaron Chapman, it's 604-822-247 UBCCHR. And we're speaking to Red Robinson, who has just released a brand new book called Backstage Vancouver. I was going to say Rockbound because you had another book before this, didn't you, Ray?
Oh, yeah, back in 1984, yeah.
Which is still out there, but your brand new book, Backstage Vancouver, is also co-written with Craig Potter. If anybody has any questions, 604-822-247. That's 604-UBC-CITR. Speaking about radio and stuff and playing stuff, you played acetates on the radio and then got bands signed as a result of that. Like you mentioned in the book, Peggy Lee. How immediate was that? What bands did you help get signed? And how much were the record labels listening to your show, and how important was it? Like, did you feel a lot of pressure, like, hey, I'm going to play this band, and they're going to get a deal? What bands got deals? Like, that's a lot of pressure. That's kind of cool.
I never worried about the pressure. I think that's the difference there. A guy like Aaron would understand that kind of thing. I never. You can't go through life worrying about what you're doing. You just do it. What happened on the Peggy Lee as an example, I was in Los Angeles, and a friend of mine, Norm Pringle, who'd been a disc jockey in Victoria, had gone down there to work for Radio Recorders, very famous recording studio in Los Angeles. And I went over to visit him. He said, Red, did you see the telethon last night? And I said, no. He said, well, my job here at Radio Recorders is to record all the variety shows on television, to send the audio to Armed Forces Radio. He said, listen to this. Here was Peggy Lee with Shelly Mann on the drums doing Fever. I kept this tape, by the way. And I was so enthralled. And the other side was Hallelujah, I Love Him So with the Ray Charles song. And Peggy Lee did an outstanding version. So I said, give me a copy. He gave me a 15 IPSC, which he wasn't supposed to do. And I took it home, and I started playing it on the radio. Capitol Records were inundated with record stores calling, saying, where's this Fever with Peggy Lee? We want it. We love it. People are going crazy. They want it. And so the Capitol Tower called me, a woman called Marilyn Hammond. I never forgot the name. And she said, Red, what are you playing? Where did you get Fever? I said, I'm not telling you. I said, but don't you think it'd be smart to bring her into the studio with this kind of action and have her do it? So they did, and she did Fever and Bob's Your Uncle. But that's how it got started.
Red, what other bands did you play that ended up getting deals from you playing them? Any that you can remember?
Oh, sure. Terry Jack's group, The Chessmen, the original with Guy Sabel, a great guitarist, who still does studio work in town. I got them a contract through a friend of mine who was the president of London Records in New York, Walt McGuire. I just said, you know, people could hear it. You don't have to be a genius. If you're, you know, my own ear, I've had a pretty good ear for picking out commercial things. And Walt said, you're right on the money. So that's where they got their first contract, too.
How powerful was the station you were working for at the time? Like, how far did it travel? Did it go to Seattle? Did it go to Portland?
Oh, absolutely.
Did it go to Winnipeg? Like, how big was it?
At night, you could hear it in Northern California. It's when, because CKWX in 1957 went to 50,000 watts, which was the most powerful radio signal west of Winnipeg, because CKY in Winnipeg had 50,000, and north of San Francisco. This was a powerhouse. I kept some of the old letters. You wouldn't believe. I get letters from Wake Island in the Pacific, letters from Alaska, letters from Missoula, Montana. But that was after, like, nighttime. So I did an afternoon show, and then I'd come back and do a night show. And I did that because I was promoting a thing called rock and roll that I loved.
This is purely a collector scum eBay type question, Red. But what do you think is the rarest record or acetate perhaps you have or was sent to you? For instance, legendary DJ Rodney Bingamheimer out of L.A. I don't know if you ever met him at all. Did you ever meet Rodney Bingamheimer?
No, I'd like to. Haven't.
He was sent many acetates and stuff, like the first recordings of Black Flag or X to play on a show. And it's like, to Rodney from X. These are, like, priceless. Were you sent anything like that? Would that be possibly one of the rarest items that you have? Like, hand addressed to Red, you know, from the Everly Brothers. Not necessarily actual releases, but acetates or something. Is that amongst some of the rarest stuff you had or you've lost?
No, I've got them. And again, you're right on the money. I have a few from Roy Orbison, who was a dear friend of mine for 27 years. And who else was I thinking of the other day that I... Oh, Jerry Lee Lewis. When he did Breakup, I've got the original 45 acetate. They probably only cut about four of them. And a couple others like that, yeah.
Was it hard to turn down payola? Because you were offered payola, weren't you? Was it hard to turn down payola? And how much were you offered? And how good was the payola?
I wish it was true. But, you know, in Canada... Payola, it was nothing because the whole country accounted for Chicago's sales. I can't say that I turned down Temptation because I never had it.
What do you know that other people might have got out of payola? Do you know any DJs that actually got something out of payola? Something really good?
I know a lot of them. I know a lot of them that did.
Like, what were they offering them? Like, was it almost nothing compared to their...
It was clever. Sometimes it would be cash in an envelope. Other times it would be, how would you like a brand new lawn planted at your house? How would you like your teeth done? I mean, it was subtle, you know.
How about the intimidation? Like, how would you like your teeth done? Like, play this record or we'll punch you out. Why did they even have to ask you for money? You know, or offer you money?
It wasn't like that. It wasn't like, play the record or we'll punch your teeth out. It was, we'd like you to give consideration to it because of the power of your audience.
Like, why did they need to give you money at all? Why couldn't they just threaten you and just start throttling you?
Well, I don't know. You put that in your book.
What bands? What bands particularly benefited from payola? Do you know?
I couldn't tell you that at all. There were some, but you know, they had the payola investigation in 1959, a congressional investigation in the United States, and a lot of it was a joke because, you know, what people didn't realize, we're going back to the time of Al Jolson. People like Cole Porter's publishing company would go to Al and say, hey, do you mind singing this song, Begin the Begin, tonight? Not that necessarily. I'm just giving an example. But, yeah, so it had been around. It's called Pay for Play. They used to pay, different performers to do their songs, Irving Berlin, all of that. So it wasn't that it was new. It was, some people say, well, it wouldn't be a hit unless, they got paid to play it. But that wasn't true either because an audience didn't know somebody got money to hear it.
Caller, are you there? Hello, caller. Caller, are you still there?
Can they invest in a new phone system for you?
Caller, please phone back, 822-247.
I'll contribute. You're taking pledges?
UBC, CITR, well, kind of. We're asking people to please buy. No, please, check out Red Robinson's brand new book. This is Timmy's Christmas Telethon. You worked on quite a few telethons, didn't you, Red?
I was the main host of that show for 23 years, and I was very proud of it because it was different than Variety. We brought in acts and people that I really knew for a long time, and people like Glenn Campbell and Freddie Cannon and Mary Wells, the late Mary Wells, and others. And it was wonderful because I love the Lions. I still do. It doesn't matter where you go in the world, there's a Lion. And let me tell you the difference between them and other groups. These guys, when somebody needs a wheelchair, they go out themselves and they will help people out. I love them, and that's why I stood there in front of the camera 24 hours every year to help raise money. And proudly, for the children of British Columbia, we raised $100 million in those 23 years.
Red, 822-2487-604-UBC-CITR. If anybody has any questions for Red Robinson, banned songs. What songs were banned? What songs do you remember not being able to play? And have you ever said the word fuck on the radio?
No, that's why I said John Lennon told me to F off the stage. I don't think it's
Well, do you want to say it right now, Red?
No, I don't. That's not my number.
Okay, well, if you want, you could.
I don't think I need to draw attention by using any words like that. I thought it was an art, not using the words. It was too easy to use the word. You talk to some of the great comics, in Hollywood. They never used that.
Well, I guess what I was curious about was, what were the words you were not allowed to say on the radio back then, in the olden days of rock and roll, and what were some of the banned songs that you were not allowed to play?
Well, fuck was one of them, okay?
Oh, wait, you just said it! All right, Red! Welcome to the 21st century! Yeah! This is your life! Ba-boom!
No, none of the, George Carlin's famous words you can't say, all of those applied, of course. About songs being banned, there were quite a few. There was one called Death of an Angel, which was so morbid, but it was a rhythm of blues song.
Wow.
And there were other rhythm and blues
like
songs.
Baby, Let Me Bang Your Box?
Yeah, well, I don't remember that one, but Clive McFadder's and the Clovers, Love, 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 I Need It in the Moonlight, I Need It in the Middle of the Night, all of those kind of songs, there were sexual innuendos, and many of them were banned, yes.
What do you know about female DJs? You know, DJs seem like really a real guy thing. Were there many female DJs out of the Northwest or Vancouver or anywhere that you encountered?
Well, in those, you're talking back in the 50s and 60s?
Early days, yes.
There weren't any. There was a woman on one of the networks in the States that would come on at midnight, and she sounded very much like Marilyn Monroe and all of that, but... No, it just wasn't the thing in the 50s, not even in the 70s. It started coming in late 70s and 80s, and I think a good woman disc jockey is just as hell. I find it even better than having a male on the air.
Yeah, totally, and I guess that's what I was wondering also was about female bands, girl bands, the Northwest. Like in the book, you mentioned Bonnie Guitar, the Valentines. What were the Northwest groups that you remember that had females in them or that even played instruments and weren't just kind of barbershop quartet-y?
Well,
like Bonnie Guitar played a guitar, right?
But she was, first of all, I'll give you the answer. Bonnie Guitar, definitely one. She was the one that, with Bob Reisdorf, formed Dalton Records. She was she had the ears, and she also was a good musician and knew how to put music together. She put together the Fleetwoods. There was a female singer in that group, if you remember. She put together the Ventures, the Walk Don't Run guys, and all of the Dalton Record recording artists, Vic Dana, everything, because Bonnie Guitar knew what she was doing. And what was the second part of the question? I get lost here. I'm getting too old, I guess.
Well, just girls that maybe played their own, like girl bands in Vancouver. Were there any girl bands you remember? Were there any all-girl rockabilly bands? Like there was Wanda Jackson in the United States of America. Sort of stuff.
She was great.
Yeah, was there anything like that locally?
Yeah, we had one that went on to fame. Her name was Lucille Starr.
I.e. Loretta Lynn.
Yeah, well, Loretta Lynn used to live in Linden, Washington, and come up here and play in the Jorth Road Hall, which was a...
Where was that?
A dance hall. So you know what I'm talking about. Loretta did, yeah. And,
wow.
But Lucille Starr sang...
Bob and Lucille, the Canadian Sweethearts, is that...
That's exactly right, her and Bob Regan. And, of course, later on she went on solo. She's still alive today and living, I think, down in Florida. But she had a big hit song with Herb Alpert's A&M Records called The French Song in 65.
Ayo, you have another question for Red Robinson.
One of the people you feature in the book, and it's who deserves, probably writes his own whole encyclopedia himself, is Hugh Pickett. And there's amazing stories that Hugh has in Backstage Vancouver.
Question. And we were so lucky, Aaron, to be able to capture him. I went to see Hugh just a week before Christmas. He's 91 now, and he's frail physically. But the brain is sharp, and of course, when we did these interviews over the past 2 years, incredible. And this is something no one knows, and we'll break it here on Narwhal's show. But while I was sitting there, I looked at Hugh, and I said, Hugh, you know what disappoints me? I mean, without your help, there were tears coming down his eyes because I said, without your help, this book wouldn't happen. You are an icon in this province. If no one tells you, I'm telling you.
Yeah.
The old man got a little choked, and I said to the person that takes care of him, Gordon, I said, you know, Gordon, it's sad that no one has done a story. He said, well, two guys started out writing, and one of them you and I know, Aaron, and they kind of walked from it. And that was disappointing. And I said, but somebody's got to do a story. He said,
yeah.
Red, he said, come here. So we went out of the room, and he said, I don't want this with you there, but you know what we've done? I said, no. He said, in the last 4 years, we have recorded stories with you on tape and now committed them to disc.
Wow.
I said, oh, thank God, because there's a book there.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Red Robinson, what else did you host? I mean, you were a radio host. Did you do any wrestling at all?
Only mud wrestling, and only with a T-shirt on, because people kept saying, it's no good, but wear the T-shirt. No, of course not. I mean, I've done radio, I've done television, never been interested in movies, never was.
Like Gene Kaninsky, you know what I mean? Like any of the wrestling
sort of
thing.
Oh, he's a good friend
of mine.
Yeah, did you host any of the wrestling? You know, like the wrestling on TV, or did you ever go to any of the wrestling matches?
No, it wasn't my number. No, never liked it. One of my DJs, Ed Carl, I used to call him on
Ed Carl Stampede Wrestling.
Yeah,
one,
right.
One other thing A.O. Chapman would like to ask you about Red Robinson. If anybody has any questions for Red Robinson, it's 604-822-2487, UBC-CITR.
Get close to my dinner time, too. I've got about 10 minutes left. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you very much for your time. We really appreciate it, Red. Is the Milkshake Murders. A.O. Chapman has a question about the Milkshake Murders.
Yeah.
Well, I've done a bunch of research and
Busy Dialer, yeah.
And done a bunch of work on Rene Castellani.
What are the Milkshake Murders for people that don't know, and maybe Red could comment a bit about it, too?
Well, I'd be interested to know what Red would know. But Rene Castellani was a DJ on CKNW, and in 1965, the radio station did a promotion with BOMAC on Broadway, before it was Toys R Us, of course, back in the day.
The big sign,
and Rene Castellani got up on there, and he was broadcasting. And they'd throw to him for various spots and stuff like that. And you could drive by and you'd see his laundry out on the line there and whatnot. But he was apparently sneaking down in the middle of the night and poisoning his wife. And it was a huge story at the time. But it's sort of fallen into Vancouver rumor now. Did you know Castellani yourself at all? Or
I had met him, of course, yes.
Yeah.
He fell in love with a woman and decided to do away with his wife, the way I remember it. And And it was milkshakes. I don't know where he went to Lions Drive-In or one of them, and got milkshakes for. And it was laced with arsenic. This was the story. And just fascinating. Of course, he died in Nanaimo of cancer years and years later when he was released from prison. You know?
Yeah.
What a story, though.
Amazing. It sounds like a film noir sort of story.
You could make a film noir out of that,
And Backstage Vancouver, I gather, has sold well. It was like number two on a book listing or something that I saw.
Just before Christmas, it was number two.
Yeah.
And still, people are sold out on it. We're just delighted. But what really got Greg and I delighted was that we'd only been out 3 weeks, and we were the fifth best-selling book in British Columbia in 2004.
What were the books that were ahead of you? Who's the competition, Red?
Oh, I don't know. I'm not a publisher.
Yeah.
And you don't want to promo them either. And that's how you survived all these years
Harvard
in
publishing.
The industry.
Howard White, yes. Howard White believed in the project from day one. He's the guy that believed. Well, he's the one that published
the Encyclopedia of BC.
Exactly. And I have a lot of respect for Howard. And it's mutual. And good on him. I hope he makes a ton off this thing.
And just winding up here with Red Robinson, 604-822-2487, UBC-CITR, if anybody has any questions for Red Robinson. Red, you were talking about sales and stuff there. You put out Elvis, a Canadian tribute. How many copies has that sold? That's a record of some of your interviews, I think, with Elvis. How many copies has that sold? Must be quite a few now.
I'm looking at my wall here, and I've got a double platinum for it. The original was on vinyl, of course, and came out in early 78 after Elvis had died.
And that's your Elvis interviews, right?
Yeah, well, no, they're just little pieces in between, but all of the songs, it was a project that Ed Preston, who was the vice president of RCA, and myself put together at the time. He wanted me to do it. I supplied the pictures, and a guy called Mac Lipson in Ottawa, because he'd taken pictures of Elvis when he was there, and it went double platinum.
What tapes have you lost? What tapes have you lost over the years? I once lost a tape of an interview I did with Depeche Mode, and I'm so angry, like I lost my Depeche Mode interview. What tapes have you lost over the years that you'd love to get back? Like ones that the tape recorder didn't work or you've just lost?
Edie Amin, that one I really...
Holy cow.
No, I didn't. I'm kidding you. No, only one. I've only lost one. Eddie Cochran.
Wow, what happened to that one? Was it just not recording?
No, and I've got all the other tapes from there. I even have the photos of the two of us. And I don't have the interview. It's always...
And was it a good interview?
It was good. Because what people don't know about Eddie Cochran, if you're into rockabilly at all, this guy was an innovator. He had two-track machines and made it sound like today, you know, with a multi-channel board. He was amazing. And died so young in a cab accident in England.
Some of your stuff has ended up on eBay. Why is that, Red? It was indirectly kind of ending up on eBay. Did you need the cash? Why was that? Or were you trying to share with others?
What do you mean?
I've heard that some of your stuff has ended up on eBay indirectly.
Oh, no. What I did? No, I haven't done that for a year. I wanted to see how all this would work, and that all I put on eBay was duplicates. I certainly don't need the money, but young Gary Olson, who put together the Prowlers CD, and my Sunrise, the Dawn of Rock and Roll CD, too. He's a very clever guy, and he works right there at CITR, and it was on the air last night.
On air with greased hair every Thursday night.
Absolutely. No, he said, look, why don't you, let's see how it all works. And it worked well. And I thought, hey, that's fascinating.
For, I learned something. For the collector scum out there, Joey Shithead of DOA has a garage sale every little once in a while. Is there going to be a Red Robinson garage sale? Can we get our hands on stuff if we are ready to pay the price?
Well, I have not thought of that, but it's about time at this age of my life. I better start thinking about it. But, you see, I am not a guy that's in love with material goods, so it doesn't matter a damn to me. The only thing that matter to me are the photographs, the interviews, and certain recordings matter.
Caller, are you there?
Hello.
Go ahead to Red Robinson.
Yes, Red. How are you doing?
I'm fine.
Red, I got one question, and there's a song that came out in 1959, I believe it was called The Big Hurt, and it's a woman singer, and she used a kind of a phase effect in her vocal. Do you know who that singer was?
Yes, her name was Toni, T-O-N-I, Fisher, and it was called The Big Hurt. She also did one called West of the Wall, all about the Berlin Wall, and it was written by a guy called Wayne Shanklin, The Big Hurt, and Wayne had also written a monster record for Frankie Lane called Jezebel.
Wow, you got a great memory. I'm glad
I always wondered
about that. And yep. The other thing I just wanted to relate to is that the Beatles concert, me and a friend went there, and you were talking about security. You know, we turned into a parking lot off Cassia on our little motorcycle, and their limo pulled up right beside us, and we got, you know, like 10 feet from them. We waved them, they waved back to us, but these days, I mean, not a chance.
No, and that's true, by the way. They were supposed to stay in the Georgia Hotel, but they were so upset by the outbreak at the Empire that they just asked the guy to take them to the airport.
Really?
Any other questions for Red Robinson, caller?
Oh, that's it for now. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, caller, and doot-doot-a-loot-doo.
Doot-doot-a-loot-doo.
And you're still listening to CITR Radio, FM 102, Cable 102, Vancouver, Chicago, Canada. Red Robinson, just quickly here, Elvis Presley, I mentioned that Elvis record you had. You go to all the conventions. Have you learned anything new about Elvis recently? Have there been any new revelations? Or have you learned anything about Elvis in the past couple of years that you didn't know before?
Well, yeah, because I've become good friends with his best friend, Joe Esposito. And no, I don't go to conventions. What I do is that, and I didn't even, I had never been to Graceland until 5 years ago. What happened was they invited me down to MC the Elvis Week events, the concerts put on by all of the guys that work with Elvis. And I tell you one thing, and I mean this from the heart, whether you liked Presley or not, whether you believe all of the rotten things written about him, I want to tell you, every single friend, and you can back this up with my wife, that we met, if you can judge a man by his friends, Elvis was a hell of a guy, because these are wonderful people.
Have there been any little tidbits, though, you've been able to get that maybe regular people haven't had the chance to be able to get into? Because regular people don't always get to go to the back rooms of Graceland. Like, did you get to go on any secret elevators or anything like that at Graceland? Like, seen any special places that nobody else has seen? I mean, you're best friends with Elvis's friend. Come on, Red. He's got to have some curiosity, eh? You got to ask about the chimp or something, right?
No, nothing. Except that he did tell me that, well, not him, but Jerry Geller, who was Elvis's makeup artist and did his hair. Elvis's hair in the last 6 years of his life was snow white.
Wow.
Ba-boom. Red Robinson, Jerry Fiander, he's from the band The Stripes, right?
Right.
Jerry Fiander, where is he now? Is he playing with Garth Brooks? Who is Jerry Fiander? Is he playing with Garth Brooks? And what's his importance to Vancouver rock and roll?
Well, he better not be playing with Garth Brooks. I don't know where he is. His family, actually, called one time and wanted to know about him. He's one of those itinerant musicians who's probably traveling in Australia. Who knows?
How close to the big time were, like, the Stripes, the Prowlers, Les Vaught, like the early Vancouver rock and rollers? How close were they to the big time? I think they are the big time right now because they're recording Stand the Test of Time totally. But were they close at all to getting anything, say, like Eddie Cochran or up there?
Les almost made it with the Blamers, which was written by a Vancouver writer. And it was charted in a few markets in America. But we didn't have the infrastructure in Canada. We didn't have people who knew how to produce records. We didn't have the wherewithal to promote them. We always had the talent, but we just didn't have the system.
What happened with Les? How come the Blamers didn't do it for him? What happened?
Well, I don't know. It's just that, you know, you've only got so much money, and you've got to go on making a living. He had a family, and, you know, they just don't take the next big leap, which would be to a Nashville or a Los Angeles or a New York or a Chicago.
Red Robinson, author of Backstage Vancouver, winding up here, you ended up going to Portland for a little while and getting drafted. How did you end up getting drafted if you weren't an American, or are you American?
No, I'm born in Comox. No, what happened there is I realized, and I'm sitting there with a huge radio audience, and I realized that television was going to be big. And all we had in Canada, in Vancouver or anywhere else, was CBC. And I said, my God, I've got to get some television experience. I couldn't get it here. So I made inquiries, and oddly enough, King Broadcasting in Seattle offered me a couple of shows in Portland, Oregon. One was, I ended up doing Portland Bandstand. And so I went down, did a radio show and a television show because I wanted to get the experience. Part of the deal in those days was if you were emigrating to the United States, the consulate general told you, particularly at my age, I was 21, you can be drafted. I said, I don't give a damn, and that's how that happened.
I was curious a bit about the Portland scene, Red, the Frantics. I'm going to end the show with playing a song by the Frantics. What can you tell people about the Frantics in the early Northwest scene? Were you hip to all that sort of stuff? Because there's pictures in Rock Band with you and the Frantics.
Oh, yeah, they were a Bob Reisdorf group. There were so many of them, you know, the Viceroys, the Frantics, the Wailers out of Tacoma, who I thought were one of the best, by the way. Not Bob Marley's Wailers, but the Tacoma Wailers. Nothing in particular. They were just Portland and Seattle had tremendous garage bands, as we did in Vancouver.
Do you remember the Wailers playing Vancouver or the Sonics? Did you ever see the Sonics?
Absolutely. They all did.
Do you remember where they might have played? Like, just so people can go out and find those locations. Are those locations still there?
Well, the old, what's that on Davie Street? Help me here, Aaron. I'm getting tired.
Which end?
It used to be the Elegant Parlor and all that. The Embassy Ballroom.
Oh, that which is now Numbers.
There you go. Yeah. There you go. Yeah.
Where is that?
That's it's a gay club now.
Yep.
Yeah, but it used to be that's right. The Embassy or whatever they were.
Yeah, and downstairs with the Elegant Parlor. Yeah.
It was called the Embassy.
And there were venues. Yeah, there were.
And
venues.
That's where the Sonics and Wailers played.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, and they played the Pender Ballroom. Back to that, and they'd all come out and play the Forum. Cullen would bring groups in, and we'd do that. Yeah.
What about Rockbound, your co-writer Peggy? What happened to Peggy?
Sadly, she died a year ago of diabetes.
Oh, that's very sad. Because she had some amazing stories, and she was from back east.
From Chum, Toronto, yeah.
Yeah, it seemed like there was a lot happening with Chum at CKLW. Were you ever offered anything from CKLW, you know, the Boss Radio that was happening out of there, and Rosalie? I saw a big show on TV on CKLW.
The Big Eight, yeah. Oh, she was... She had more power than anyone ever in the history of this country of picking music up, because the audience encompassed Detroit, and just a lot of the cities around our border in America, and great influence. But along came CanCon rules and goodbye CKLW.
In your new book, Backstage Vancouver, you don't really thank any Holiday Inns, but you thanked Holiday Inns and Rockbound.
Well,
how come?
Well, because I'm such a commercial whore. No, come on now. You know who can back this up is Aaron, because that was different. Rockbound. Town was a national book, and I'm sure Backstage Vancouver will have some interest, but Rockbound was of national interest, and we had to travel all across the country and stay at inns and, you know, thank the airline and everybody else. It cost a fortune.
But there is some holiday connection to Backstage Vancouver, the Keith Moon piranha story. Maybe you could leave us with that. Do you remember that, Red Robinson? Keith Moon and the piranha in Vancouver, British Columbia, what? Canada?
In his bathtub.
Yeah, the Keith Moon of the Who. Something happened, right?
Well, you tell him.
Well, I just remember he bought a piranha in Vancouver, which I thought was pretty amazing.
Oh, like, yeah.
The piranha came from Vancouver. And I think that was when they were on tour with Herman's Hermits, which was pretty amazing.
Well, they were the opening act for Herman's Hermits. I mean, can you believe that in itself? No, but Keith and these guys, I mean, Keith was out of his mind. A lot of them weren't so high, they didn't know what the hell they were doing, just having fun. And sometimes damaging themselves. In the end, of course, he did the permanent damage to himself.
Yeah.
But, yeah, he had a piranha, and people were screaming and yelling and all that crap. And anyway, they got it out of the hotel, so.
Well, thanks so much for calling in to the Nardwuar to Human Serviette radio show here today. Red Robinson, author of the brand-new book, Backstage Vancouver, available from Harbor Publishing, Red Robinson, and his co-writer, Greg Potter. We got to give some shout-out to Greg Potter, too,
Greg,
right, Red?
Very much so. Without him, it couldn't have happened. And I mean that sincerely. Not only that, as I said throughout the program, my greatest respect is for writers and for Aaron and for you.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. Nardwuar, I'd love you guys to come down to our office and have a look around at our memory.
We would love to.
And we'd like to invite people to check out your website, too, because it's got some great pics there.
Great website, redrobinson.com. Yeah,
thank you.
Redrobinson.com. Red, why should people care about Backstage Vancouver? Why should people care about it?
Because Vancouver, I'll wrap up by telling you this. There's only 5 cities in North America that could have a book like this, and they are Los Angeles, New York, Chicago, Las Vegas, and Vancouver. Maybe one other or two others. And the reason is we had the venues. This is the place the performers came. They loved it. They told other performers to come here. And it is a rich history, not only of people that visited here, but it allowed people like the Michael J. Foxes and the Jason Priestleys and other people to spring from here because they would
make
connections.
Some people would say that's bad, though. Ba-boom.
What?
Some people might say that's bad, that we're to blame for Loverboy, or we're to blame for these bands. I love them, but some people don't always like that stuff.
Well, who cares about cynics? The world's loaded with them. I like to go down a different path.
Oh, right, RedRobinson.com. Well, thanks so much, Red. Really appreciate you calling in. Keep on rocking in the free world, and doot-doot-a-loot-doo.
Dot-bop-a-dee-boop-bop-bop.
Not quite.
Okay, do it again.
Doot-doot-a-loot-doo.
Bump, bump.
Oh, right. Well, thanks so much, Red. Talk to you later.
Thank you,
Red. Thank you, bye.
See ya, bye.
Bye.
That was Red Robinson.
Amazing.
A.O. Chapman.
What a guy.
A legend.
A legend.
And you're right up there with him. Aaron Chapman.
No, you're too kind.
We'll have to ask you back to go in a bit more about the Howard Hughes
thing.
Now, people might have been listening this past little time here on the Nardwuar to Human Serviette Radio Show. Briefly, the Howard Hughes story, where it's available, and the Milkshake Murders, where it's available. And your song, The Milkshake Murders.
Sure. Well, go to, if you could go online to the Van Courier. .com. If you look up the December 15th issue of The Courier, the downtown edition, there's the Howard Hughes story. Or you can even just drop me a line via the AaronChapman.net website. Hell, I even got a website myself I'll push.
Aaron@AaronChapman.net.
That's right. Yeah, drop me a line.
It's a great story about Howard Hughes in Vancouver. And hopefully maybe you'll come back to the Nardwuar to Human Serviette Radio Show and tell that. And the Milkshake Murders
Milkshake
song.
Murders,
hopefully
and
we'll
the,
be able to play that as well.
And the Milkshake Murders featuring some of the guys from Blue Rodeo and Matthew Good Band and all sorts of people playing on a song.
And about, some more filth!
Dirty tour stories, the whole nine
yards.
I will name names.
You're going to name names. And any gigs coming up for you in the Town Pants or Bofifus King?
Bofifus King at the Commodore on January 12th.
Are you playing in that band?
Yes, and...
what are you playing, by the way? Tin Whistle.
I know, I play harmonica and musical saw, and I am sort of Bofifus King's little sidekick there. And it's a pretty fun band. It's a pretty cool. And also the Town Pants. Yes, indeed. That's different music, of course.
And when are the Town Pants playing next?
Town Pants playing Railway Club February 12th, a month later.
And how about your autobiography, Get in the Bed, Aaron
Get
Chapman.
In the Bed. The Real McKenzie's tour diaries.
Because you were an early member of the Real McKenzie.
Yes, that's
full
true.
Full of filth.
A lot of good stories.
And you name names.
I do name names.
When is Get in the Bed coming out?
Well, you've been the strong proponent of trying to get me to publish that book after I read some stuff on the air. I think I don't an old Nardwar show about that. Well, and it's true. I want to do that. And you'll probably be the guy that will urge me into publishing that book. But there will probably be heads will roll, or people will come after me saying, "How could you name me?" I'll be kind though.
Well, anything else you
want? It's an amazing story. It makes getting the van look like a Cub Scout story.
You grew up with the real McKenzie.
Yeah,
you grew up with the real.
That's
McKenzie.
True. I was like 21 when the band started. Yeah, and I left like 6 years later, 5 years later.
And Aaron Chalmun, anything else you want to add to the people?
No,
out there?
Pleasure to see you again. Happy New Year to you, Nardwar.
Anything about the book, Backstage Vancouver?
The book, I will throw out all bias whatsoever and try to be, you'd normally try and sound, of course, unprejudiced, but it's a hell of a book, and if you and you should pick it up. You can see it in most local bookstores, and it's worth, have a look through it because you will walk away with a copy. It's a pretty amazing book, and it was pretty cool talking to Red Robinson today, I think. So.
And right now, we're going to end with a song that influenced the Cramps. Yes, Red Robinson.
Yes.
Influenced the Cramps.
Yes.
The Cramps have a song called "Don't Eat Stuff Off the Sidewalk." Do you know that song? Don't Eat
yes.
Stuff Off the Sidewalk.
Yep.
And there's many great stories about
yep.
the Cramps. For instance, when Lick the Pole.
When Lick the Pole.
Lick the Pole. What? Quickly, Lick the Pole
Lick
the and
pole,
the Cramps.
And Lick the Pole opened for the
amazing
Cramps.
Amazing Vancouver band.
Amazing
I use the word amazing a lot, but they
and
amazing.
I worked that
and
night.
And that's one thing about the Red Book. You kind of wish it was a bit more about the
I
town.
You know
punk,
what?
The modern day
if,
stuff.
If Red Evers are going to do Backstage Vancouver Part 2, I can supply a bunch of good stories about Lick the Pole opening for the Cramps at the Commodore.
And they opened for the Cramps, and then what happened afterwards? The party went going right down the stairs all the way to the Chateau Granville, right?
Yeah, you got it.
And the Cramps did "Don't Eat Stuff Off the Sidewalk." Don't eat stuff off the sidewalk. But that actually was inspired by the Frantics, who know Red Robinson, and their song, the Frantics song, "Werewolf." And so we're going to end with the Frantics from 1959 doing "Werewolf," who inspired the Cramps. So it all goes back to a Red Robinson. And thanks so much, AO, for coming out today.
Thank you. Good to see you again,
Arlo. I really do appreciate it. And
My
coming
pleasure.
Up, the CITR news and doo 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 doo.
Doo doo.